Our first case for argument is Rosario versus the Retirement Board. Mr. Hunt.
May it please the Court. My name is Keith Hunt. Together with Michael Buckley Bolin and Bradley Faber, we represent the plaintiff appellants and the putative class members in this case. I will be handling the equal protection, due process, and immunity arguments, and Judge Bolin will be handling the remaining arguments. We request that this Court reverse the District Court's dismissal of the complaint in this case. It's important to note at the outset that the pension code remained the same throughout all relevant times in this case. Prior to 1992, during the interim period, which is the focus of this case, from 1992 to 2008, and thereafter. But starting in 1992, the pension board began systematically and automatically denying all requests for credit for prior service by pension applicants who had previously served in Cook County or in other qualifying capacities.
Could I ask one preliminary question? As far as those people who had prior experience somewhere else, were they without any kind of a pension or vested interest in that? Or I'm just wondering whether there'd be a double payment or whether they did not get something.
There would not be. The way the pension system is set up in Illinois, these people request prior service be transferred over from the county to the city. The issue, I think, then becomes whether or not the county transfers the money that goes along with that, but that's really a separate issue. That doesn't consider the issue that's raised in the statute, which is that these people are entitled to credit for that prior service by virtue of having served. If they were to apply for two separate pensions, it would reduce the total amount that they would receive, even if they were vested in the county. If they weren't, of course, then they would have no credit for that prior service.
I see.
Can I ask you one other preliminary question, Mr. Bolin? Has anybody asked the state courts to decide whether the board can reopen any of your clients' cases?
We have not, because there was never a final decision that was subject to administrative review by the pension board in this case. What the pension board did is, in essence, put these pension applicants in a trick box. After the Rosario case was decided by the appellate court in 2008, there were a series of requests for rehearing by people who had previously been denied pensions by the pension board, or credit for prior service by the pension board. At that time, rather than conducting a hearing and making a decision that would then be subject to administrative review to the circuit court, the pension board instead decided not to put these people on the docket at all. They weren't placed on the agenda.
Is there a mandamus remedy for something like that if the board is simply refusing to consider something properly before it?
There may be, under an appropriate circumstance, a potential for a mandamus action. But we submit in this court, given the fact that their due process rights and equal protection rights were being denied, an alternate and equally available remedy would be the one that the plaintiffs chose in this case, which is to pursue.
What is Rosario doing in the case? He has no financial stake.
Rosario, unlike the other pension applicants, he applied, was denied, and then took administrative review to the circuit court, which affirmed the pension board decision, and then was forced to take an appeal to the appellate court. So we believe that Mr. Rosario has suffered economic damages.
What does that have to do with the class claims?
That's an individual claim as well.
So what's he doing as a class representative?
Well, he's an individual who, like the others,
has nothing to do with the class.
His claim is not typical.
It may be.
He does not belong in this case. He has his own, as you just said, individual claim unrelated to the claims of the class members.
We believe he was typical of the other class members in terms.
No, he won. He got his money. That is extremely untypical. The class plaintiffs are the losers, and he's a winner. He doesn't belong in the class.
Unfortunately, the district court never got to that point.
It doesn't matter. He doesn't belong in the class.
Well, certainly all of the other individuals do belong in the class. And based on the Rosario decision by the appellate court, they were entitled to receive the same and equal treatment as any other pension applicant. Because after the Rosario decision came down, the board then changed its policy and began treating everybody wholesale on a different basis, where they would grant the credit for prior service based upon the Rosario decision. All of these people were similarly situated. They had all served at the sheriff's office or in other qualifying capacities. They were all Chicago police officers who had put their time in.
Are you suggesting that every change in law has to be applied retroactively?
Well, certainly the court...
Otherwise, there are arbitrary differences in treatment of people who are similarly situated. That's pretty novel. Every civil decision is retroactive?
No. But the difference in this...
What's special about this one?
Well, the difference in this case is that there was a procedural mechanism that was available under the pension board rules. Under the Ardley decision, which I think you're referring to, that talks about whether or not there's a retroactive application, in that situation, there wasn't a procedural mechanism. But in this case, the pension board rules specifically authorize a rehearing process. And there were timely requests made immediately after Rosario was published, and these people made requests for rehearing. And contrary to the position that the defendants took and that the district court adopted, there is absolutely nothing in the Illinois Pension Code that prohibits a rehearing. The pension code is silent.
If that's right, I mean, your constitutional theories reach very, very broadly, as Judge Posner's question suggests. And if this procedural mechanism is so readily available, why not simply go to the state courts to order the board to actually think about this problem? I mean, I think we can all appreciate the fairness issues, but we also have to worry about issues of finality and litigation and just how broadly these principles that you're arguing would apply.
And we're not arguing that this applies in every civil case. We're not arguing that this applies wholesale to every...
So what's special about this?
Well, what's special about this is that we're dealing, first of all, with a finite group of individuals, approximately 50.
That won't do it.
That's nothing.
Second of all, we're dealing with a situation with a pension board, which according to Illinois law, the trustees of that board have a fiduciary duty to the police officers, the applicants, and the annuitants. And they are specifically...
Well, if they have a fiduciary duty and they've breached their fiduciary obligations, you have remedies under state law. Don't you?
There may or may not be, but at the time...
There may or may not be. I don't understand that.
Well, if
state law creates fiduciary obligations, then the breach of those obligations is actionable.
Back at the time they breached the fiduciary obligation prior to Rosario. But what we're arguing in this case is that in light of Rosario,
the retroactivity issue, right? You have a change in law, and now you want everybody who is adversely affected by the earlier overruled law to have a right of recovery.
But the pension rules in this case, unlike other pension board rules, unlike other cases where there's been a final decision, the pension board rules in this case specifically provide for a right to have a pension board rehearing. But the rule requires that it take place at an open meeting and upon the request of one or more of the trustees.
They violate their own rules. Don't you have a state law remedy?
But that's not exclusive to a constitutional remedy.
Yes, it is. Of course it is. If a state is violating state law, I don't understand why you don't. This is really Judge Hamilton's first question. Why don't you seek a state remedy?
Well, part of the issue was that when we approached the pension board in the first instance.
It's a pension board. You have a judicial system. You're asking them to give an effect, retroactive effect to the Rosario decision. So why don't you go to them and ask them for that? To the state courts and ask them.
This was the remedy that we elected. That's simply the answer that I can provide at this point. What I can say is that...
Okay, your time has expired. Mr. Bolin?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Michael Bolton.
Well, wait till you get to the stand.
I don't necessarily.
Otherwise, the recording will not get you.
I'm sorry.
Won't know your name.
But know your name. That's a good start. Your Honor, my name is Michael Bolton. I represent these policemen. Now, to correct the court, there's no change in the law. The law never changed at all. The retirement board thought it changed the law by an interpretation. There's no change in the law. Rosario is the first and only decision interpreting this statute. Now, this court has actually decided this case in a similar case, Volan versus In re Volan, 1937 case, where you said this, if you have a board, a quasi-judicial board, making decisions, you got a financial interest in it, it's void. It's at 69 Fed 2nd, 475 at 476. Cited at page 44 of the brief.
What's the name of that case?
Volan. It's kind of like Bolan, but it's Volan. V-O-L-L-A-N-D. And in there, the Seventh Circuit says, talking about benefits that go to the judicial officer who's benefiting, says, even though it does not actually enrich him, in other words, we are merely applying the rule of the master in any whether judicial officer or quasi-judicial officer is disqualified as he has an interest, however small, in the general or special fund of the property affected by the suit. Now,
are you taking, counsel, are you taking the position that any public retirement board violates the Constitution if it has beneficiaries or potential future beneficiaries on its board?
The Seventh Circuit seemed to think so. The United States Supreme Court seemed to think so.
I don't see that case,
I see it, sir.
I don't see that case cited in the briefs at all.
It is, Your Honor.
Where?
Volan, V-O-L-L-A-N-D?
I don't see it in the list of authorities, but we can let that go for now. But are you taking the position that if Illinois wants retirement plans to be run by boards that include people who receive funds under that plan, it violates the federal Constitution?
Right. Absolutely, positively.
And where do we find that? I mean, Volan sounds new to me, but anything else?
The cases I cite in here, Caperton. Also, the...
Caperton is really not comparable.
Okay, then Toomey versus Ohio.
Nor is Toomey, where you had...
What
I was looking in your complaint, counsel, to see this theory of bias and self-interest on the board. Do I find it there?
Paragraph 50, I think, is the one in particular, and of the Second Amendment complaint. Let's see.
For their own personal gain.
50 and 51, yes. Paragraphs 50 and 51 of the Second Amendment complaint, record are 341. Yeah.
Okay. Let me understand the theory there. Is the theory that this decision will increase their own pensions or will simply enhance the security of the overall system?
Neither one. It gives the policeman what he paid for and he paid into. They paid into the fund. They lost the time. How can they repay this guy, man or woman, who's worked 9 years?
That's not the question. The question has to do with the personal financial stake you're saying members of the board have.
Yes, okay.
I'm trying to understand what that stake is.
All right. Four members of the board are participants and get pensions from the pension fund. That's every decision they make, denying or granting a petition for transfer. And this is a portability act. Petition for transfer affects the totality of the fund.
Okay, so there's no direct effect.
Yeah, it is direct effect.
On how much Commissioner Jones gets paid?
Right. On his pension. At the availability of funds to pay his pension. If he are unavailable funds,
let me try this again.
They have to raise
Does
taxes.
This decision produce a measurable dollar and cents difference in the checks that the board members receive for their own retirement?
Yes.
How?
If there's no money in the fund, you don't get any money.
So it's the overall security and stability of
Indeed.
The fund. Is it, in your theory, does it violate the U.S. Constitution to have taxpayers serve on that board?
No, that's not one of the
criteria. Wouldn't they face the same kind of incentives that if, because under the Illinois Constitution, conceivably, if the system runs short, the money has to be made up from tax revenues.
That's right. There's a Supreme Court case on that.
So who's eligible to serve on this board?
Those who they say, but you cannot have a conflict.
Now, who's not a taxpayer or a commissioner or a participant?
There are another four members of the board who are appointees that are not going to receive pensions from us. The treasurer of the city, the board chairman, the man, he was the man from Northern Trust who just passed away, a very nice man, and two other city employees. They are not going to participate in the fund.
They're taxpayers.
They indeed are.
So under your theory, they're ineligible?
No.
Why not?
Because the criteria for qualifying for a pension either is you're a policeman and a participant in the fund, or you are a retiree, an annuitant in the fund, that's under Section 178 of the Pension Act, or you're one of the three policemen, who an officer of rank, a patrolman, and a lieutenant and a sergeant, who are fund participants, and they've been contributing to the fund all along. Those are the people who are have the dual nature of being participants in the fund, yet they have the conflict. Every petition they turn down is good for them. That's what the Ohio case said. You can't have it both ways.
In Toomey, the judge took a piece off the top of each fine he imposed. Well, the mayor judge, right?
But not of the not guilty.
Exactly. Well, that was the problem, sure. But that's not what happens here, right? Because what you're talking about is just the overall financial stability of this fund, right?
In part, that's one way to view it. But mm-hmm. I view it from a different view. You know, and the point of it is, they knew better than this.
Board denied rehearing, yes. Couldn't you have challenged that in the Illinois courts?
I don't believe so, Judge. But I don't know.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Judge.
Bowen. Mr. Ryan?
Bowen, that's it. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Joseph Ryan on behalf of the appellees. Initially, I'd like to address the issue about the scheme, statutory scheme, and the rules of the board with regard to rehearings, which I believe was incorrectly stated by the appellees. The pension code does not contain a provision allowing for rehearings. The schematic and scheme of the Illinois statutory laws provide for the administrative body, that being the board, to render a decision which is subject to judicial review under the Illinois Review Act. There is no provision in either that Act, the Pension Code, or the Review Act allowing for rehearings. The appellants are arguing that the board rule, there is some ambiguous language, stating
that... Does that mean the board has never granted a rehearing?
Well, the board can grant.
Because even without an express statutory authorization, a board might feel it was authorized to rehear a case. You know, felt it made a mistake. Someone says you made a mistake. They say, all right, we'll give it further consideration. Would that be illegal?
No, it wouldn't be, Your Honor. But in that situation, it would not be. But I assume that the rehearing is going to occur before the 35-day statutory provision.
No, I understand. It would have to be before the deadline for seeking judicial review.
So under that situation, you would have two options. One, you could seek a rehearing before the administrative panel that's within 35 days, or seek judicial review by appealing it under the Review Act. Now, as I was saying, they're relying on a rule that's promulgated by the board. It's very ambiguous. It talks about rehearings. However, if you read the rule, even though it's a little ambiguous, it does say that this is subject to the provisions authorized by law. So we have to look at the statutes to determine what is given and not given to the pension board. If you look under the pension code, no provision for no provisions for rehearings by the board. However, you do have the Review Act, which does allow for the review of the pension board decisions.
Is that the one that has to be filed within 35 days?
That is correct, Your Honor.
But is there anything beyond that?
After 35 days?
Mm-hmm.
No, there is nothing.
So it's sealed and done.
Right, correct. And there's finality, and I think correctly stated and analyzed by Judge Tharp when he was ruling on the motion to dismiss, he acknowledged you have to have some finality to decisions. Otherwise, at any point in time, could be 4 years later, 5 years later, 10 years later, if some judicial panel or court decides to interpret the law differently, and does that mean everybody in the past for 10, 15, 20 years, whatever it may be, now can run to court? They have another day in court in the application of the law that is now present and presently decided by a judge?
Is there anything under state law that would allow some sort of reentry there?
Yes. Actually, the SOLA case addressed that a little bit. I could talk about the factual situation, SOLA 1 and SOLA 2, and they'll answer your question and also support my argument about the Pension Code and the Review Act. In SOLA 1, Mrs. Sola received benefits from a pension fund, cost of living increase. She was advised that the board believed that that was improperly granted to her. She went into court and got an injunction against the board from having a rehearing on whether the cost of living increase should be denied or cease to give it to her. The court granted that. That was Sola 1. Court ruling in Solo 1 was that there was no jurisdiction to hear that because the board did not appeal within 35 days. Okay. Another party, the village, is upset. It thinks it's a wrong decision. Several years later, the Supreme Court rules in Roselle that there should not be a cost of living increase given to petitioners such as Mrs. Sola. So the village decides it's going to go back in the court or go before the board. Now, to answer your specific question, in Solo 2, that's exactly what the village did. They filed a mandamus act along with some other claims to get the matter into the court system to address it. So what happened in that court system when they did that and brought it there? The appellate court looked at this and said you cannot have a rehearing. One, there is no provision under the pension code for rehearing. The schematic set up in Illinois is for the decisions of the administrative body be appealed to the judicial system within 35 days under the Review Act. And it may be very desirable to go back in time and say, Mrs. Solo, you don't deserve your cost of living increase, or to any other individuals that may be receiving it, but that's not the law.
Did anybody appeal within 35 days?
In Solo?
No, in our case.
Yes. In fact, that's what I think is so ironic, and the court even, I think, touched upon that. You have several plaintiffs, six or seven plaintiffs in different states. You have Mr. Rosario, who actually appealed within 35 days, lost in the trial court, took it up to the appellate court, and prevailed. And that court held that the board was misinterpreting Section 214, the Pension Prior Service Code provision, for the last 15 years. So he's the perfect example of how the system's supposed to work, how you receive equal protection, and how you receive due process. He received everything he was entitled to under the Illinois and federal constitutions and the state laws of Illinois.
But he's the only one that timely appealed, apparently.
No, he's not. Because what happened, the other plaintiff, Mr. Razzo, did the exact same thing about 8 years earlier, before Mr. Rosario. He lost before the board. He appealed. The trial court affirmed the board's decision. He appealed to the appellate court, and the appellate court ruled in favor of the board and said, you are correctly interpreting this statute. And then some of the other plaintiffs, not all of them, did elect to appeal under the Review Act to the trial courts. Those decisions were all affirmed in favor of the board and their interpretation of the statute. They just elected not to go further. So what's happened here is you have about five, six plaintiffs that have used a system that's set in place, that's constitutionally permissible, works. They used it. They just didn't get the result they wanted. Mr. Rosario, to his credit, did get this, a favorable decision. But does that mean that every decision that was rendered by the board, the trial court, or the appellate court in Razo should now all of a sudden be overturned and for naught? Every order be void? No. And I think they also misinterpret and mislead this court by saying there was some kind of systematic change in the law. What happened was before 1992, there was conflict about how to apply the statute, some confusion. In 1992, 1993, they started denying the applications, and they continued that process. And as I pointed out, some of the plaintiffs, along with other individuals who are not part of the class, appealed those decisions. They were all affirmed. So the board isn't doing something half-cocked. It's getting a message from the trial courts that it's interpreting the statute correctly. So it continues to do so in the way it believes is the correct interpretation. Then in 2000, which is about 8 years after they started, you know, interpreting it different, Mr. Razo takes it up to the appellate court. And although it was a Supreme Court 23 order, it still sent a message to the board, we're interpreting the statute correctly.
In your view, Mr. Ryan, is plaintiff's only remedy a legislative one? So, I mean, the appeal of their claims, just to sort of a kind of intuitive sense of fairness, is pretty strong. They're being treated differently. People who were similarly situated before 92 are got that credit. People since 2008 are getting that credit. They're not. I understand the legal arguments. Are you saying that a legislative solution is the only one?
I believe so, Your Honor. I think the statute has to be changed if they want the relief that they're seeking. Because the court system has already provided the due process and equal protection laws or protections that they're entitled to. And I think that's not only demonstrated by the pension code, the administrative review law, but the Solo case, Solo 1 and Solo 2, which clearly are analogous. There's no difference between Solo 2 and this case. In both cases, there was an administrative decision that someone didn't like. The 35-day period expired. In Solo, the Supreme Court rendered a decision that clarified a statute. In our situation, we have an appellate court rendering a decision clarifying the statute. And then after those decisions, somebody's trying to get a rehearing.
Is there any explanation for why Rosario alone appealed to the Illinois Appellate Court?
I'd have to ask each of the individual plaintiffs that question. You know, it's their prerogative to
see.
There's
nothing in the record about that, why he decided to appeal.
To the appellate court, no. Just like I couldn't answer that question for Mr. Raza, why did he appeal?
Right.
He's no different situation than Mr. Rosario. They both appealed to the appellate court, but the appellate courts rendered different decisions. And the statute hadn't changed.
Right.
So the decision, the interpretation the board had, they believe was correct. There's no reason not to believe that it's correct. The other thing about, they're trying, the board, also at least the trustees, are entitled to immunity. Regardless of what happens, they're entitled to judicial immunity under a quasi-judicial immunity theory or qualified immunity, because there is no dispute that the decisions that they're making considering whether to grant or deny the pension benefits were quasi-judicial decisions. They hold hearings. People testify under oath. They hear other evidence. They look at the law, and they make judicial decisions. I don't think the plaintiffs contest that, because I think it would be hard-pressed to say that at least the initial decision denying the application was a quasi-judicial decision. What they're trying to argue is somehow the decision that not to have a rehearing is not a judicial decision. It makes no sense, because to decide
you're not you're not contending, though, that the board itself is entitled to immunity, are you?
The board, as a body itself, no. Just the trustees themselves.
They're not seeking damages from these, from the members, are they?
Yes, they are.
They are?
Oh. They are seeking monetary damages from all the parties in the case.
Okay. Thanks.
Including board staff?
Including John Gallagher, the executive director.
Mm-hmm. Is that it?
No. I'd like to mention one other thing, is that's dealing with the self-interest argument. I think there are argument, I think the court correctly seized upon some of the nonsensical argument in that, because any time the board could never render a decision on any matter before it concerning the pension if you accept the plaintiff appellant's arguments that somehow there's self-interest. And actually, I cite a case, E.E. Hollings. It's an Illinois Supreme Court case decision where the village of Hawthorne brought an action trying to argue that the County Board of DuPage had a self-interest in the applications that were being filed by a petitioner. The petitioner wanted to expand a landfill. The argument by the village was that the board was indirectly receiving $30,000 a month in the application fees, and so therefore they had an interest in granting those applications. And the court held that that was an insufficient basis to argue that somehow there was some self-interest, that there are always decisions that are being made by governmental officials that affect the revenues of a governmental unit. That's my last point, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Ryan. So, Mr. Hunt or Mr. Boland, do you have anything further?
Thank you, Judge. Solo's an aptly named case because that's an individual case, okay? Is it a case, is an individual determination? We're saying here something different.
So what if the Supreme Court, what if the Supreme Court of Illinois decided that the decision for Rosario was incorrect? Would then his judgment be vacated? Is that your position?
I don't see how they could, in the first place, having worked there.
I don't understand. What if the Supreme Court of Illinois decides that, well, really, the appellate decision in the Rosario case had been erroneous, and
their time to make that move is gone, Judge.
Right, but somebody else can do it, right? Somebody else can bring that.
No policeman's going to go sue the.
This is a hypothetical.
I'm anxious to answer your question.
The Supreme Court of Illinois might go back to the old interpretation. And if that happened, my question is, you know, is what sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander? That was Mr. Ryan's point about the Solo case.
There's only one decision.
Does this go both ways? That your conception of retroactivity of...
I'm not even thinking retro, Judge.
Well,
I'm not.
Of course you are, because these are people who didn't pursue or to successfully pursue their judicial remedies years ago, and now they want, on the basis of a change in law, they want their whatever benefits accrue from this change. I'm just saying, well, suppose it went the other way and they had prevailed, and then the Supreme Court of Illinois comes along and says, the way Rosario says, no, that's all wrong. Would the board then, the state, be able to reach back and rescind whatever benefits these policemen had received?
Yes, Judge, by statute. Section 178 of the Policeman's Pension Act. That's what we're talking about in this case. Going forward, increasing your pension, you can recalculate it the other way. For instance, every time there's a payment out wrongfully.
Are you answering me or not? I'm just asking whether this is symmetrical. Your concept is symmetrical, so that if the law changes against the policeman, they have to give up these benefits.
If the law changed, law didn't change, but if it did,
the interpretation changes, and as a result, Rosario is no longer the law of Illinois, does the state, the board, whatever it is, get to go back and rescind whatever benefits these people obtained under... You know, like Rosario obtained a benefit of some sort. Now, is that contingent on Illinois state courts continuing to believe that he was entitled to what he to win?
Yes. The legislature passed a law. They relied on the law when they became policemen. You can't take that away from them.
You are not following my question.
I thought it was. Pardon me. They can't. Well, they wouldn't. It'd be retro. It'd be prospective.
Let's try.
Let me finish.
Okay.
You're not understanding me. Rosario won in the Illinois Appellate Court. Now, suppose years later the Supreme Court of Illinois decides that appellate decision by the intermediate court was wrong. Can the state, the board, some other official body go back and say to Rosario, we're rescinding the benefits that the Illinois appellate court said you were entitled to because the highest court in the state has said that was wrong. You shouldn't have gotten those. That's my question.
No, they can't go back.
Why not?
Because you're depriving them of property without a due process. So it's prospective only.
Why is it depriving them of property without due process? The Illinois Supreme Court is more authoritative than the intermediate court. So if it decides he wasn't entitled to this benefit, why isn't the state entitled to restitution from him?
Restitution implies a wrongful receipt. They took it under color of law.
Look, restitution is the standard remedy to recover money that's been paid by mistake. Now, if the Supreme Court of Illinois says the Illinois Appellate Court made a mistake, they gave him benefits mistakenly, why can't the state get them back?
Perhaps. As you say, it's a hypothetical question.
And what's the answer?
You're looking for a balancing act.
Pardon?
Is the court looking for a balancing act? If it had sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander?
We're trying to understand how far your reasoning extends. It may not be hypothetical. I can certainly imagine the board saying, with all due respect to the Illinois Appellate Court's decision in Rosario, we think it's incorrect. We're going to deny the next application for somebody similarly situated.
Yeah.
Respectfully go to the circuit court and say, we know Rosario controls this for you. You're going to rule against us. We'll ask the appellate court to reconsider, and then we'll take a direct – we'll ask the Illinois Supreme Court to reconsider. And they could do that, right?
Theoretically, yes.
Okay. And if they overruled Rosario, not in his case, but in somebody else's case, could the board go back and recalculate Mr. Rosario's pension? Whether they're seeking restitution or not, could they cut his payments prospectively?
Yes, that's under Section 178, 5.5.178 of the Pension Act. Recalculation. There are like situations where there are like back pay allowances and they paid the guys too much, and they recovered under that section.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Ballard. Now your time has expired. We're going to move on. So our next case for argument, Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin versus Van Hollen.